Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're exploring the idea of research. It's sort of the idea and research behind doing physical therapy before surgery. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, we like to do things like that. Larry Mueller here again. And we have Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW's Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, thank you for coming by.
Great to be here on another beautiful Wisconsin winter day.
Yeah.
At least it's not so cold.
It's nice. And, you know, and the Berkey's next weekend.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. So is central Wisconsin looking good for snow?
Mm. Yes.
Good? Is it?
Yeah.
It should be a great year. The temperatures are nice.
Great.
The snow's good. Yeah.
There'll be lots of aches and pains and sprains after
that.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes, there will.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, a physical therapist, athletic, is an associate professor, in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, it's great to see you again, obviously.
Great to be here.
You know, there's some research out there, and we've talked, you know, we've kind of talked about this in the past on the show at from one time or another. You get a meniscus tear and, you know, should I get that scoped or are there other ways to do it?
Absolutely.
And there's some research on it.
Right. Well, I believe that the arthroscopic knee procedure is the most commonly performed arthroscopic procedure today. And one of the things that they do arthroscopically is treat meniscal tears. So there was a really nice meta-analysis that was done, and it took all the studies out there and looked at whether when you have a meniscal tear, should you have surgery or should you manage it conservatively? And what they found with 800 patients is that long-term, there were really no difference in the outcomes between the people who had surgery and the people who were managed with physical therapy. So in other words, it looks like physical therapy and managing this conservatively is just as good, if not better, than going in and having surgery to remove that meniscal tear.
Isn't it interesting because my left knee, I had surgery on that one. And then on the right one, I was scheduled for surgery.
I remember that.
Yeah.
And the doctor said, you know, you could try Synvisc.
Right.
And I went on Synvisc, which is an injection. And I am so happy I did that. It's been, it took about 8 weeks for it to take hold. A little therapy work.
Right.
And I think that's part of it. It's the wait for it. I think we get so impatient that we think, oh my gosh, I have to have the surgery and have to have it done, where in reality some meniscal tears will actually heal on their own if they have a blood supply. So you're a perfect example. And of course, the study is a great example that not everybody needs to have surgery if they have a meniscal pathology.
Right. Yeah. And surgeons are very aware of this as well. So they're not rushing in to do surgery on these people. We're seeing that people long term, if they keep those meniscus tears in place, they can function very well with those. And honestly, we don't know anything about the people who tear their meniscus and never show up in a medical clinic because they have self-managed it. So even these studies that show that conservative management has as good as outcomes as surgical ones, it doesn't even include the people who have injured their knee and not even shown up in the clinic and gotten in these studies.
Right.
So I think that provides more evidence for that. Now, that being said, if you're having locking, things like that, that's a different case where you have a body that's getting in the way and causing more irritation in your knee. But for the average meniscus tear,
right. And the other thing is we don't want people to be walking around without their full range of motion. So if that meniscal tear is precluding you from getting your knee fully straight when you walk, things like that, then you definitely need to be seen because that will set you up for more pathology, more issues.
Yeah.
So. Right.
So there's, I was just thinking about in my own case, I'm not sure that Synvisc was even the first time around with mine, if it was even there. But I remember it was a while. It took a little bit of time to heal from the surgery. And with the Synvisc, it wasn't any time. And it was much less painful. And
You know, it's interesting. I'm seeing somebody now who is doing the Berkey next weekend who is considering getting a knee replacement because she was having some pain on the inside of her knee and she has some arthritis. And I said, you know, looking at you, said you can ski for 3 hours. you have some pain on stairs, and you have full range of motion. I said, if your knee looked like this after knee replacement, that would be an excellent result. So there's nowhere to go but down from
right,
there.
Exactly.
So again, and it's the long run. It's the this is what we talked about last show, was sticking with it for the long run.
Right.
It takes a long time for some of these injuries to fully recover. And if you stick with it,
you know, and I'm glad you brought up you're seeing somebody before the Berkey, because that reminded me to talk about physical therapy. If you do have surgery, the physical therapy before surgery.
Prehab.
I've heard you say.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You want to go into surgery. If surgery is the best choice for you, you want to go into surgery with that knee in optimal condition. So making sure that you do have adequate range of motion and strength. Mobility, good balance will set you up for success postoperatively. I always tell patients who are, they're like, oh, I don't know if this is going to be managed conservatively if I'm going to have surgery. And I always tell them, don't think of the PT that we're doing now as a waste of time if you go on and have surgery.
Sure.
All
you're
doing is making your recovery so much better.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. The people who have planned things like a joint replacement and come in and done rehab in the month beforehand and gotten themselves in really good physical shape have avoided things like going into a swing facility afterwards.
Yeah.
And they've been able to go directly home because they're in such good shape.
Well, we have callers online. By the way, you can join in with your questions. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Mark in Platteville up first here. Mark, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. So I took a little bit of a fall on some ice on the concrete driveway like a week ago.
Yep.
And so I fell on my side, and I think I probably have bruised ribs. I did call to see if I should make an appointment to see my family doctor, and I talked to the nurse, and it seemed like there wasn't, you know, much that you can do. You can't operate on, you know, if it were broken even. And I'm wondering about, you know, how long should it take, whether I should for this to really start, you know, feeling better and allowing me to move better. Is there any exercises to do? If I should consider getting one of those wraps? I know there's a wrap that they sometimes use for you to kind of keep you in, you know, sort of a straight position in your rib area.
All right, good questions.
Well, some of it depends upon how bad the bruise is and how bad your pain is and what you need to do in your life. So if you're in a physical job and you need to move, then having some support for those ribs makes sense. If you're in a fairly sedentary occupation, you spend most of your day sitting, then I don't see the purpose in having a brace or support because you need to move. So the idea is that as your ribs allow you to move, you should move, and that is reaching your arms overhead, bending forward, bending backwards, twisting, just gently mobilizing those tissues so that as they can heal with the appropriate loading forces, we would say.
And sometimes just using what I call a self-splint to do the transitional movement. So sometimes going from sit to stand is painful. What a lot of people will do is they'll cross their arms and kind of give themselves a hug with their hands when they go from sit to stand. And that may be enough of a short-term brace for you to use for those small transitional movements until they're less painful.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll, you know, a bruised rib or an irritation of the rib, unfortunately, it takes a long time for it to recover because every time you take a deep breath, you cough or you sneeze, it's really painful.
Yeah, and you're really aware of it.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
And you have lots and lots of your abdominal muscles that attach there. So, you know, you're going to probably be feeling fairly good in 2 weeks and probably ready to rock it out in 4.
There you go.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling, Mark.
That.
Yep. Good luck. Thank you. Nancy in Grafton up next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. The story about going to exercise, that is a great idea because it was over 17 years ago. My husband and I had been going to an exercise place, you know, and then, oh my gosh, his knees, he was a construction worker, retired, and they hurt so bad. So he went and had both of his knees replaced at the same time. Well, 2 weeks later, Bob was climbing the ladders, picking the leaves out of the eave trough.
Oh, man.
And, you know, he went a couple months ago. He had to go back and have those knees checked. And when the young gal looked at the x-ray, she said, "Oh my gosh, I've never seen anything this old." And he has not had one day ever since this surgery was happening. You know, and when the doctor asked him, "How you doing?" after he, you know, came back for his checkup, I kind of opened up my mouth and I said, "Oh my gosh, could you believe 2 weeks after he had the surgery, he was climbing the ladder and he was taking the leaves out of the eave troughs, and the doc was smiling from ear to shiny ear." My boy, you know.
Great story. So it can, yeah. Obviously there can be really good results.
Yeah, very much. Really, in terms of recovery, the better shape you're in,
exactly.
Whether it's weight management or range of motion or strength in your hips and in your low back to help you recover from that, those things make a tremendous difference. If you can get yourself up out of a chair, get yourself up off the bed, those things make a huge difference in your return to normal daily activities.
Tommy in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have Ehlers-Danlos, which is a connective tissue disorder, which causes me to have a lot of pain, joints popping, tendons popping. I've had many surgeries. I've had over close to 30 surgeries.
Wow.
I've had knees replaced, ACLs, and I didn't know I had this, why this kept happening to me until a couple of years ago.
Wow.
So I seen a geneticist, Dr. Basil, who sent me to a place called PT Plus to help with my pain and issues with it. I said, there's something I can do. I don't want to take pain pills. I don't want to be on that wagon and a zombie. So they sent me to this PT Plus. And there, they were the first people that could get me, not pain-free, but manageable, easy to live, doing it. In the process, I ended up having a Chiari, which was
a disease as well. God.
And before the surgery, because they thought, we can help you with this. We can help you try to get over this. It wasn't working. It just became unmanageable. The headaches were, I couldn't take it. I had to have the surgery. But the therapy before the surgery, after I had the surgery, I was smiling. The doctor goes, "You're smiling. Why are you smiling?" And I said, "The pain's gone. The pain's gone. Wow. I feel great." And so he goes, "Well, I'll come back tomorrow and see if you're still smiling." Well, I had to go in ICU to recover. And in ICU, they said, "You're doing great. I don't know. We don't have patients that are doing this well." And I'm not young. I'm in my 50s. And I said, "I think it's because of the therapy." And so they basically kind of kicked me out of ICU and put me in a regular floor. And I can't say it enough to people to get that therapy. It's such a difference.
Yeah, it's interesting. I see a number of people with Ehlers-Danlos or generalized hypermobility syndrome, and I'm always amazed at the number of people who are undiagnosed. So they see somebody for a shoulder problem, and then a hip problem, and then a knee problem, and then they sprain their ankle, but they're all different episodes of care, and nobody puts it together until they show up with a lot of pain, and they just have pain everywhere. And it's not a difficult diagnosis to make, at least the hypermobility piece of it, whether it's genetic, as in the Ehlers-Danlos, and there's a number of different types of Ehlers-Danlos.
And what is it again? Describe it to me.
So it's called Ehlers-Danlos, EDS, and there's about six different types of it. And it's a genetic connective tissue disorder. So in the most common type of Ehlers-Danlos, it affects the connective tissue in your joints, so your joints are very hypermobile. They're the people who can, you know, swing their arms, put their hands together, and bring them back over their head. People say, "Oh, it's good to be flexible," but being too flexible is probably worse than being inflexible, because you don't have stability in any of your joints, and so therefore they end up with surgeries until somebody figures out that this is an underlying issue. Then there are other types that are vascular. Some that can affect your heart, so that it can be a very serious disease. And it sounds like with her Chiari, she had a vascular component as well. So it's good that she got help, and physical therapy can help with this.
Right, because what happens with that when you have so much instability at your joints is now you rely on the muscles to stabilize. So your non-contractile structures are all stretched out and you rely on your muscles. So fatigue can set in, muscle soreness, pain, things like that.
So I often get diagnosed with fibromyalgia yes. because of the muscle pain, right. but they miss the underlying hypermobility.
And how do they? How do you find it, or how is it?
Well, the hypermobility is diagnosed pretty simply with a score. It's called the Batten score, and they look at your elbow hyperextension, at your thumb to forearm, knee hyperextension. I think
ability
it's a score.
To touch your hands flat on the floor.
Flat on the floor, bending forward, yeah. So it's a score of 0 to 10. So that's a simple way to look at hypermobility, and then the EDS, if it's genetic, that a geneticist does that.
Mm-hmm. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today, as we take a look at physical therapy issues. What about you? Join in at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Brandy Funk, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at aches and pains and sprains and strains with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the University of Wisconsin. Great to have them along. And again, there's, I think, one open line at 800-642-1234. So give a call. Let's go to Mary in La Crosse. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I think the thing about being patient really fits with plantar fasciitis, and I wondered if you could talk about the cause and length of recovery and the activity level 5 recovering and prevention of further problems.
Sure, that is one of those diagnoses that takes a long time to recover. So your plantar fascia runs on the bottom of your foot from your heel up to your toes and can become irritated a multitude of different ways. If it's has to do with your foot mechanics, sometimes it's inflexibility or a tight calf muscle can cause it. But the classic symptoms are pain with those first few steps in the morning, and then pain if you've been sitting for a prolonged period of time on the bottom of your foot.
Usually it's back at your heel or just to the inside of your heel. And mechanically it's because you have this wide fascia that attaches basically at the base of all your toes. So it's pretty broad there, but it all comes back to attach to one narrow spot on the back of your heel. So all that load is transmitted to your heel. Sometimes people will have an x-ray and there'll be a little spur there and they'll say, oh, well, this spur is causing my pain. The spur is just a sign that you have tension there. But it's not the cause of your pain, and going in and removing that spur will generally not relieve your symptoms. So sometimes it's shoe wear, you know, for people who go to Florida on spring break and they go from wearing, you know, winter supportive shoes in Wisconsin to wearing flip-flops for 4 days walking around Disneyland, and then it flares up their plantar fascia. So then the treatment is to get them back in a good supportive shoe, one that supports your plantar fascia. Some stretching for the calf muscles, as Jill suggested, if your calf muscles are tight. We like a night splint. Mm-hmm. I like a night splint because what happens when you're sleeping in bed at night, your toes generally point down, so the fascia on the bottom of your foot becomes shortened. Then you go to stand up and you put all your body weight on and you stretch it suddenly, and that really hurts. So if you use a night splint, it holds your foot in an up position and keeps that on stretch.
And something as simple as modification of what you wear around your house. If you have hardwood floor or tile, linoleum, things like that, and you walk barefoot or in little slippers that don't have very much support, that can be problematic as well. So what I usually encourage people to do is get a pair of tennis shoes and make them your inside tennis shoes and just always wear those around your house so you're always supported, and then you can transfer them to your outdoor shoes and get a new pair of inside shoes. But little things like making changes, not going barefoot at home to shoe wear, I think is really important.
Yeah,
and it takes a long time.
It takes
a very long time to get over this. But if you stick with it, usually you get better.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. And Gretchen in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
So I have a lot of trouble with my right shoulder. And I have been diagnosed with thoracic outlet syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what you guys think about that and what you recommend.
That's a great question. So thoracic outlet syndrome is typically, it's kind of a diagnosis of exclusion. So, well, if you don't have other things, you might have thoracic outlet. So how I explain it to patients is you have kind of a neurovascular superhighway. All of your nerves and arteries and veins run through a really tight space between kind of your neck and your humerus, so kind of in that upper chest area. Uh-huh. And there are lots of different places where the either the artery or the vein or your nervous system can get pinched or entrapped. And then what that does is that causes symptoms down your arm, whether it's numbness and tingling, whether it's my hand is falling asleep, whether it's kind of venous or swelling into your hand because the blood supply is not getting back up. Many times a certain position will bring it on. So if you have to put your arms overhead quite a bit, or you carry a heavy backpack that depresses your shoulders, or a large-breasted female, many times bra straps can actually dig into it and irritate your thoracic outlet. So, yes, it exists, and it is difficult, somewhat difficult to manage because we're not really sure where that actual entrapment is happening. But many times doing mobilization through the first rib and the cervical spine are helpful, and then neuromobilization is very good, and then many times it's postural correction, making sure that the posture, the position you're sitting in, isn't constantly irritating or pushing on those nerves, arteries, or veins.
Correct. So,
What else can I say, really?
Well, it's funny because I only wear certain bras because I can't have any pressure, above the clavicle. I can only do limited things with my right arm, even though that's my preferred hand.
Sure. Right.
And so my left, does a lot of things that I don't think it would have done had it not been for that. I mean, I've even skied the Berkey a couple of times, one arm.
Yeah.
Because, skiing the Berkey with my right arm, it's too long. So I saved that for the important thing.
Right. So if you've done those things, that Jill has suggested, and the neuromobilization, the stretching of your chest and pectoral muscles, upper back strengthening, those are your go-to things. The other thing to keep in mind is you could have an anomaly in the neurovascular bundle. That is, sometimes a nerve will run over a tissue that is supposed to run under, or vice versa, or you may have a branch of something that's anomalous, and that may be why you're continuing to have symptoms when other people would respond to that.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Mike in Boulder Junction, let's turn to you now. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I was just calling. I had an issue with a knee problem, and I ended up having surgery on it. And it didn't help a lot, and I had problems with it. I had a back surgery about 8 years ago, and I developed a lot of radiating pain in my arms and legs, and I suffered through that for a few years. And the only comment I had is that I was eventually diagnosed with Lyme disease, and it took 14 months of treatment. But all those issues, my knee problems and everything, have been gone, and I just wanted to mention that. Just, I'm a big supporter of it. I'd rather go to my physical therapist than to a doctor for most stuff. But I still just wanted to mention that about Lyme disease, because everything I had, I thought was physical, but since I was treated for Lyme disease, I'm feeling the best I felt in 7 years.
Isn't that interesting? It's one of those things where, you have knee pain, you have back pain, they do some imaging, they see some pathology, and they say, that must be causing your symptoms. And for many people, there's pathology on an MRI in your knee or in your back, but it doesn't cause symptoms. In fact, and we've probably said this on this show, when they originally developed MRI, they did MRIs on a lot of people to determine what normal anatomy was, to teach people what normal MRI anatomy was like. Half those people had disc herniations, but they were asymptomatic. We see the same thing with knee arthritis. It's a huge issue where the diagnosis is made based on radiographs. Well, you can take 100 people, and half of them will have arthritis, and half of that half won't have any symptoms at all, or have no idea they have arthritis. There'll be other people who have pristine radiographs who have arthritic complaints. So Mike's a good case where it may have been the Lyme that was speaking that whole time, causing the pain, and just because they found the pathology, they said, that must be causing it, and had surgery and didn't get better. So
yeah, there we go. Thank you very much for calling, Mike, and reminding us about the Lyme disease. Appreciate it. We had Sue from Duluth had a question about bursitis. What causes bursitis, and is the inflammation? Is there a way to speed up recovery?
Well, bursitis, you have lots of bursa around your joints, and basically they're little balloon-filled sacs that help lubricate and help tendons and nerves as they glide around the joint to kind of decrease friction. That's their whole job. And what can happen is if you get too much pressure on them from lying on them, for example, our greater trochanteric bursitis on the outside of our hip, if you lie on it too much, you can irritate it. Or if the tendons that cross the area are really tight, that can irritate it. Or if you just use them too much, you kind of create friction, kind of like a guitar string rubbing back and forth over the bursa, that can irritate it.
So. Right. And so what do we do for it? Well, first we look at the underlying cause. Is it something in your posture? Is it something in your lifestyle? And we start with correcting the underlying cause. Then in terms of treatment, if it's relatively superficial, ice works well. We do stretching if we feel like there are musculotendinous issues that are perpetuating the problem. So we'll do stretching, we'll do strengthening to create better balance around your joint. And if all else fails and that's not helping resolve the problem, then judiciously used cortisone injections into the bursa can be helpful. And what that does is it just shrinks that bursa down, so then sometimes the therapy can become more effective.
And on Facebook, Mary Ellen says, I'm in my 60s, reasonable height and or weight, rather, and fitness. I've been treated PTE dry needling and orthopedic consult for a tendon inflammation on top of my left foot by the big toe. I continue to have discomfort with walking and standing. What can I do to aid the healing?
Well, it sounds to me like she's got some tendonitis in probably her extensor hallucis longus or the tendons that go to your great toe. And dry needling is one way to kind of get rid of the trigger points that irritate that muscle. The biggest thing probably is to look at her foot mechanics. What people don't realize is that every time we take a step and push off, we have to have a lot of mobility in our great toe for normal gait mechanics. So if she's having some sort of pathology either in her rear foot that's causing abnormal load down into her great toe, So she needs to have her foot looked at by a physical therapist who kind of specializes in lower leg, ankle, foot, and see what's different side to side or what can be done for that. Potentially an orthotic might help her.
Yeah, I'm wondering if she's seeing a PT for dry needling. I would hope that PT evaluated her foot mechanics and treated the underlying cause. It sounds like the dry needling is treating some of the trigger points in the muscle, but the question is why did those get there in the first place?
Right, and they'll keep coming back if you don't address that underlying cause.
Right. So, and whenever I think of the great toe and that first joint, I also think about gout.
Yes.
That's what I thought about right away.
Yeah. Whether there's, because that can be overlooked.
I've had gout. I know.
Yes.
That's exactly where it happens.
And it's very painful.
And it's very painful.
Very painful.
Yep.
Rick in Greenfield, it's your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a 6-year-old guy, and for the last 4 years, 3 days a week, I've been going to a boxing gym just to stay in shape. Mm-hmm. The classes are an hour each, and usually starts with like 10-15 minutes of rope skipping, and then the rest of the time is pretty much you're supposed to be on your toes, moving around different angles. I stopped going about 3 weeks ago because I was experiencing a numbness on the pads of my feet. And toes, and just a general, wake up in the morning and kind of like if you're standing around all day, you have sore feet at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. It's kind of that sensation, but no sharp pain or anything like that. But I'm, concerned about nerve damage and, just how to proceed at this point. If I should just wait a month, or will this go away?
Right. Those are great questions. Do the symptoms come on when you have been there for a while and are primarily on your toes?
It's afterwards, take off my shoes and, I can, definitely feel that.
Okay.
That's a long time to be on your toes.
Yes.
So unless you're going to be, unless you're going into ballet as your next career, that the ball of your foot was not designed for weight bearing and impacting. Okay, yeah. think about the front part of your foot, and you compare it to your heel. You got that big solid heel bone that's designed for shock absorption. Your forefoot and your metatarsal heads are not designed for that. So, you know, 15 minutes of rope skipping when you're on your toes, and then another 45 minutes of being on your toes, it's not good for your feet. It's too much time on your toes. So, you know, it's your choice what you want to do with that. If you can modify it where you don't have to be on your toes so much, or, you know, but that's just a long time to be on your toes. I would expect people generally to be symptomatic with that kind of activity.
And then the other thing is sometimes just not only being up on our toes is problematic, but if your shoebox, if you're
Toe box.
Thank you. Your toe box is too narrow. It will cause even more compression.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So now you're loading your toes and you're compressing them at the same time. So I would definitely encourage you to make sure that you have shoes with a wider toe box that when you are up on your toes, they're not getting squished.
Right. And that part
That's
of your
a
shoe
medical
is,
term.
Yeah. Yes. That part of your of a typical tennis shoe is not designed for shock absorption as well.
Shoes like boxing shoes. And I'm sure that the toes were sort of together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't think boxing shoes are very supportive as well.
Yeah, I don't know much about boxing shoes. They don't look like they are from my observation. I haven't
As far as recovery, like soaking my feet in hot water or warm water?
I'd go with ice. Mm-hmm. I'd go with something cold. I wouldn't go with warm.
Yep.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn to Ann in Madison next. Hi, Ann. Thanks for waiting.
Yep. Good morning. I'm not a big runner. I'm in my 50s, but I get out as often as I can for a couple miles. And this fall, I was running and, you know, finished and my hip hurt. Didn't fall, didn't do anything weird. And it's hurt ever since. You know, if I rest, if I don't get to the gym, you know, it kind of goes away, but as soon as I do anything, it's back. So I'm really curious what it is, and it's more than likely that you're going to tell me to go see a therapist.
Does it matter what you do at the gym, Ann? Does everything you do at the gym bother you? Because that's always helpful in trying to kind of determine what's going on.
I'll try. You know, I try a rowing machine just to not be standing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of stretching, but I want to run.
Okay. I
do the treadmill.
Okay. Know. Where in your hip? Front, back, inside,
it's
outside?
On the side.
The outside?
Just like, yeah.
Can you put your finger on it and find a spot that hurts? What?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
Probably trochanteric bursitis. Yeah.
I heard you talking about bursitis before, and I thought...
That's kind of a classic trochanteric bursitis. So, you know, my first question is, okay, you're running both feet. Why do you hurt in one hip and not the other? Because theoretically, your legs are doing the same thing. So if you're running on a slope, that could account for that. If you're running the side of the road, that could account for that. If you're running on a flat surface, then... The question is, why do you have symptoms in one side? Do you have a leg length difference? Do you have a pelvic rotation? Do you have a scoliosis? So those are all the things that we would look for. So that's why we're going to say, maybe you should go see someone.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you have a little bit, just the slightest bit of weakness in your gluteus medius, a muscle on the side of your hip. And what happens is when you run, you may be dropping your hip so slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And then that IT band is rubbing back and forth over that bursa like a guitar string and irritating it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would make an appointment with the physical therapist. I would take my running shoes and I would have them get on a treadmill, have you run and take a look at it and see what's different side to side when you run.
Yeah, so... Now, if this happened last week, we'd say, well, try these exercises, try this, try that. But it's been since the fall, and you have not successfully been able to get back to the gym.
Right.
So you need help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Well, I go to the gym, and I just hurt.
Right. Well,
that's what
you know, and I'm telling you, every time you go through that cycle, you make it harder to get out of that cycle because you irritate those tissues over and over again.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. Sooner rather than later, because soon the weather is going to be nice and you're going to want to run.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Carol in Oak Creek next. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. I'm 53 years old. I'm probably about 30 pounds overweight, and I just had gallbladder surgery. I got out of the hospital yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've never been sick in my life, so this is my first surgery. But I can't walk straight, and I can't sit straight, and I'm wondering, and I don't want to pull any stitches out, so I'm just wondering, will it come back naturally in my posture, or should I be doing something? Or the doctor didn't really say. I see the doctor in 2 weeks, you know, for a follow-up.
Well, I think moving in a way that feels comfortable makes the most sense. So,
yeah,
so
I'm in
yes,
a lot
you.
Of pain.
What's that?
I'm in a lot of pain.
Yeah. So they didn't give you any kind of restrictions at this point?
Not really. No.
Okay. All right. So this is general sort of abdominal pain.
Yeah. Okay. Where the incisions were.
Okay. Right. All right. So yeah, I mean, you should take it easy for a couple days and let those the healing process initiate, and then just start moving around your home, getting up, walking, moving in normal movement patterns, you know, sit to stand, things like that. And my guess is that it's going to come back. If you've been a fairly active individual and you don't have, it sounds like you don't have a big medical history of problems, you said you've never had surgery before, I think you should recover from this.
Right. And I always tell patients this, anytime you have a surgery and there's a surgical incision, there's a scar, they go through multiple layers of muscle and soft tissue. And so you're stretching that area that hasn't ever had any trauma to it before. So I always tell patients, you only have to stretch the first time once. And then once you get that going, it's usually a little better. The muscle says, oh, I remember this, and I can move this way again. So the first few times might be a little uncomfortable, and that's why Lori said go slow, and I concur.
All right. There we go. Thank you very much for calling, and good luck. And I assume you're home, Carol. You're not?
Yes, I'm home.
Okay, well, stay there. Don't go anywhere for a couple days.
You don't want to slip and fall or anything like that.
Yeah, that's going to be the
helping me with shoveling.
Somebody else can do that. Exactly.
Thanks a lot.
Jeez.
Thanks for calling. Well, here we are dealing with physical therapy issues with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori's an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW.
And I just wanted to throw in a follow-up for Anne when she was talking about running. I noticed that she's from Madison. I just want to put in a plug that UW Sports Medicine does have a runner's clinic, and they do assessments of runners. So you can make an appointment in the sports physical therapy department to see one of the running specialists, and they will put you on a treadmill and film you and look at your running gait and go over that with you.
Oh,
so that resource is available here in Madison.
Right, absolutely. And sometimes it's a very minor change they need to do that can make a big change in your running mechanics.
So look into that, and thank you so much for that question and gave us an opportunity to plug that really good program. There's even a physical therapy or a physical program for golf.
Yes, there is. Yes.
That I was going to try and get signed up for.
Yeah, sure. You go.
So
especially with your knees.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with my two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Net as we take a look at your aches and pains and sprains and strains with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Brad in New London has a question, so let's go there. Brad, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. Good morning for taking my call. I just want to get the opinion of the therapist on the Rolfing 10 series structural mechanics.
Okay.
And if they're beneficial, not for specific ailments, but just overall.
Just in general. Okay.
Body mechanics and movement.
If you're up for it, then you do it. For those who don't know, Rolfing is a form of sort of very deep massage, and those who have done it would tell you it's somewhat painful, but they go very deep, and it's a set of 10 sessions. So once you're in for the duration. And the idea is to loosen up some of your connective tissue and the fascia and restore normal movement of those tissues, one on the other. And there are people who are certified Rolfers. I wouldn't have anyone Rolf me who was not a certified Rolfer. And, you know, the people who do it say they feel great afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I have no problem with that if someone wants to give that a try.
I don't either.
And do you have some experience with that, Brad?
I do. I just went through a 10 series and just wondered. I did feel really good afterwards, and just wanted to get your opinion on.
So what led you to do it for our listeners?
I'm 60 years old, and I just wanted to get my body in good shape, moving well.
And how did it change that for you?
My posture improved, and when I was walking before, my left arm didn't move very much, and, mm-hmm. and she got that going again. So I think it did improve my movement.
I think that's great. Now that you have that mobility, it's just really important that you continue to use it, which it sounds mm-hmm. like you are, because mm-hmm. once you get that mobility, you want to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It can go away.
Yeah, right. It reminded me a bit of Feldenkrais, mm-hmm. which is another sort of subspecialty area in movement. And, you know, Brad noted that his left arm wasn't moving. Well, he probably wasn't aware that it was moving. So what a Feldenkrais practitioner does is looks at how you move and makes corrections and helps make you aware of how you're moving and help normalize your movement patterns.
Right. And you can get certifications in Feldenkrais as well.
Exactly. Yeah, but you may need to be Rolfed in order to move.
As a Feldenkrais practitioner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There we go.
Thank you for that, Brad.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Brad. Appreciate that information. Brendan in South Beloit, it's your turn. Hi, Brendan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've had all kinds of, like, issues from years of abusing my body through martial arts and various, like, construction, military, yada, yada, yada. But about a year ago, the last time I went to a martial arts class, I got like a pinched nerve in my neck. And since then, the pain in my neck was almost always there. And then it seemed to like transfer to my shoulder. So now it's my shoulders bothering me. My neck feels better. And you were talking before about how there's like the nerve and tendon superhighway between, you know, in that area. And I'm wondering if there's some kind of connection between the two and what kind of physical therapy type movements could I be doing to possibly improve this?
Absolutely. So all of your nerves that kind of steer your arm come out of your neck. And there's a bigger one the biggest one that comes out is C5, C6. And what that does is that kind of sends the sensation to your shoulder. And so people who complain of shoulder pain many times, it's actually truly coming from their neck, as you mentioned. So depending on why that nerve is irritated would dictate how a physical therapist would treat you. But it might be that you're a little hypomobile at a certain area of your neck and you need more mobility there to kind of unload or offset the nerve. You may need some traction to unload the nerve. There may be some scar tissue back there, and the nerve just needs to be glided or flossed in that area. So there's lots of different ways I think you could be managed with physical therapy successfully.
Right, and the other possibility is that your neck resolved, if whether you had a limitation at C5, 6, or a small disc or a facet issue going on, but you changed how you were moving because of your neck pain and you irritated something in your shoulder. So neck shoulder pain is one of the more complicated things that we see in terms of figuring out really where the pain is coming from. And particularly in cases where it's been going on for a while, there's probably a contribution of both. So it's a chicken and egg thing. So we end up oftentimes treating them both, not really knowing which is the pain generator or which came first and which came second. So
there we go.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Brendan.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. And Linda in Ashland. Hi. Thank you for calling.
See, I have a little bit different situation here. I was diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago, and I went through chemotherapy, radiation, extensive surgery, more chemotherapy. And here in March, I'm going to be coming up on 2 years, and I don't have cancer anymore, but I am going to start physical therapy. And I've tried it before, and I just don't have the stamina to keep up with it, it seems like to me. My doctor wants me to start again, and I have a couple back issues right below the shoulder blade, and then the other place is actually my neck. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions that I could bring to the physical therapist.
Well, I think it's really important that you share your cancer history with your therapist. That's a really important thing to know. And then, you know, because of all the surgeries you've had done and the chemo and the radiation, you know, you're going to be deconditioned. And so it'll be very important that your physical therapist doses you appropriately with regards to your cardiovascular exercises and any strengthening exercises that they give you.
In general, a pool would be a great place for you to start. It unweights your back. It gives you resistance to all of your movements as you move through the water. So the pool is a great place for you. And frankly, walking as an exercise is probably the best place to start, whether you're walking in a pool or walking on land in a mall, on a trail, on a track, or whatever. But just walking to build up some of that stamina that Jill talked. It's weight-bearing, which is going to be important for your bones, especially if you've gone through chemo and radiation. And then gradually progressing to a few more isolated exercises. But given your history of being unsuccessful in therapy in the past, I think Jill's point about dosing the exercise correctly so that it works for you, it doesn't increase your pain, it's doable with your lifestyle, and starts very slowly and works up at a pace that works for you is going to be the key.
Mm-hmm. And I like things like once that you are capable of doing it, I like using an outdoor high school track to exercise, mm-hmm. because if you do get fatigued or tired, your car is right there versus doing an out and back.
Yep.
So until you know kind of where you are from a stamina perspective, that's a really good choice. You may start with something as simple as walking to the corner and back 2 times a day or 3 times a day. So short trips might do you much better than a long trip.
Right. And then finally, it would be figuring out what you like to do and what kind of environment. Some people like the flexibility of doing what I like to do, when I like to do it, where I like to do it. Other people are more motivated by being part of a group. And that is, I'm going to go to a class, or I'm going to go walk with this group that walks, or whatever. So you have to figure out what motivates you and what works for your lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Good luck, Linda. Thank you for calling. And Brian in Hunter's Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I had a bursectomy, arthroscopic, going on 4 years ago, and it's just been... Like you mentioned, the T-band, I was explained the sling was constructed to move the T-band over. But this has just been all-encompassing pain. I've done a lot of therapy. I went to Mayo. They said it's ready to have that surgery. The bursa grows back anyway. And I've wondered if you had any advice.
Yeah.
Has anybody looked at your back?
Well, I have a crushed T11. A half.
Okay. All right. Because, I mean, it sounds like you have had a lot going on with your hip, but the lateral side of the outside of the hip is also a very common referral pattern for your back. So it wouldn't be a bad idea just to rule that out and make sure that it's not coming from your low back.
Yeah, I know the first thing that...
Actually, I did have that ruled out. And,
okay.
I guess it's a lot of scar tissue at the two incisions on the hip.
Okay. Okay.
And it radiates down into the lower leg and the buttocks, and I can never lay on my right side. It's like it never healed.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, as the folks at Mayo mentioned, a lot of times your bursa does grow back, and so the problem with having a bursectomy is if you haven't gotten to the underlying problem, excuse me, of why it got irritated in the first place. The mechanical changes you need to have done, it could be problematic. The IT band does attach to a muscle, your tensor fasciae lata, and it may be worth having a physical therapist do some dry needling in that area to see if that doesn't calm the muscle down that attaches to your IT band so it's not so tight. So that would be something I would definitely suggest for you.
Yeah, but I would agree with Jill that given as many people as have looked at you, and you know, my first instinct was, who took out a bursa? They grow back. So you got that answer from Mayo. And you've been to physical therapists, so I'm sure have worked on strengthening your glutes and so on. So I would agree with Jill. One of the still outlying potential interventions would be some needling in the area and see how that, if that helps you.
Yep. Yep. There you go. Thank you for calling. And Gary in Madison, thank you. Hello.
Hello. Okay, so I've had, in the past, I've had this tingling down my left arm and into my thumb and index finger, and I had been going to a chiropractor for quite a while who said that, you know, it was pinched nerves, and I did get some relief from him. But after a long period of time, it just, you know, never really kind of always went away. Then something had come up where all of a sudden I started getting this pain and deadening feeling down my left leg that would wrap around the front of my shin. And when I would bend over, it would seem to then alleviate that pain. And I've dealt with that for a long time, went to the doctor, and they told me, okay, first thing you do is I want you to take Aleve for 30 days, which I did. And he said, then after that, we should check you out. So I did that for 30 days, and it has, for the most part, gone away. But I still am feeling this tingling down in my
toes?
Left arm.
Oh, down in your left arm, yeah.
And my thumb and index finger.
Okay, in 20 seconds or so.
We may need to come back to this one. Has anyone imaged your spine, MRI of your spine, your
no.
cervical?
No.
All right. That would be next.
That would be my first
that
thought,
That would
too.
Be, yeah, yeah.
It's concerning that you have this in an upper and a lower extremity.
Right. So that leads us to think of a central canal issue, mm-hmm. which needs to be assessed.
Mm-hmm. And we can talk some more about that after we take a look at the news. Visiting today with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. They'll be back right after this quick look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us. You stay with us. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Talking with them today about all your aches and pains and sprains and strains and how to deal with them. And every one of our lines is filled, but here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And, Jill, let's go back to the caller that we had just prior to the...
Gary?
Okay.
Yes. He had called in and said that he had had some numbness and tingling in his arm, and he had sought some chiropractic care for it. And then without any mechanism of injury or anything, he also had numbness and tingling in his leg on that same side without any mechanism of injury. And we were discussing a little bit that's very unusual. And so we're always concerned about there being some sort of pathology in the central canal or in the spinal cord or the area around the spinal cord itself. And so what we were suggesting is that he have some sort of imaging done to make sure that we rule out something sinister.
Right, right. So if he came into the clinic to see me, you know, if his doctor said, well, you're having some symptoms in your leg, go see your physical therapist, I would not feel comfortable treating this person until he's been cleared for some other kind of central canal pathology.
So he'd have to go back for some imaging?
Some imaging, yeah. Yeah,
probably an MRI.
So he should suggest that now.
He should. He should go back and explain to his physician. I mean, they wanted him to try 30 days of Aleve, which helped somewhat. But the fact that he has these two kind of random conditions going on that both sound like they're coming from his back without anything to cause it is the concern.
Right, and his neck has not improved with the care that
Correct.
He's had.
Let's turn to Cynthia next in Stevens Point. Cynthia, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. So I'm 39 now, and this has been going on since I was probably 20. And what happens is sometimes if I turn my head quickly, I get like a feeling of like a crack or a pop in the back of in my neck, and then it's like a big pow of heat, and then it feels like the back of my tongue goes numb.
Wow.
I know, it's so strange, and people always think I'm crazy when it happens.
No.
It like lasts for, you know, I don't know, maybe 10 seconds, and it slowly goes away, and it's always very shocking. I noticed that as I've gotten older, it doesn't happen as often. When I'm driving, I make sure I keep turning to the sides because I find when I look straight ahead for long periods of time, it happens more frequently.
So do you have lots of mobility in your neck? Do you feel like your joints are loose?
Diagnosed me with benign hyperextension.
There you go. I'm going to let Lori handle that.
Hypermobility
syndrome.
Yeah. Okay. So the first thing is, don't turn your head fast. You're getting instability in your neck. Mm-hmm. So if you have not seen a physical therapist for assessment and for some strengthening and stabilization exercises in your cervical spine and even higher up where your cervical spine attaches to your skull.
Right. Atlantoaxial instability is what Lori and I are both thinking.
Yes. Yeah, a double A. Mm-hmm. You need to see somebody and have that evaluated. Do you have any other rheumatologic conditions? No rheumatoid arthritis or...
Yeah, I had JRA as a kid.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
And then I've had... Okay. You know, I herniated two discs in my back in high school.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then I've been in multiple car accidents.
Oh,
I've had whiplash and have done, intensive physical therapy for that.
Okay. So the number one thing we worry about in patients who have rheumatoid arthritis is atlantoaxial instability. And that is where your head attaches to your neck. You don't want to have episodes of instability where your head attaches to your neck. I can't emphasize enough how bad a thing that would be. So if you haven't been in physical therapy to specifically address this issue...
Yeah, I haven't.
Okay, then you need to do that, and your rheumatologist, whoever's managing your rheumatoid symptoms, needs to know that you're experiencing these symptoms.
Right.
And I would be careful if I were you.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't wait too long either.
Correct.
To get in.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, her history, your history, Cynthia, with all your hypermobility and then all the trauma from car accidents and things like that has just kind of set you up for this perfect storm.
Yeah.
So is it fixable?
It's manageable.
Manageable, okay.
It's manageable with lots of teaching the right muscles how to control that hypermobility that you have right where your skull sits kind of on your C1, your first vertebral segment.
Okay.
But there you go. Good
Thank
luck.
You.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, my goodness. Lots of issues there, for sure. But she seems like a sharp gal. And
yes.
Yeah, she'll manage this.
She's going to
get it taken care of.
Yep. She's got good insight. And the fact that she said she's getting better as she's getting older is because our connective tissue tightens as we get older. And for somebody like her, it's a good
help.
Thing. It's a good thing.
Well, let's find out what's on Molly's mind from Madison. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Barry and guests. I am at the other end of the spectrum. I am 66 and have been a runner in the past, but my knees gave out. And I'm really trying to avoid having knee replacement, but I do try to do as much yoga as I can now. And I've recently retired, but I know I am just generally a lot less active. I'm gaining weight, and I find that the more strenuous yoga classes can really, they seem like, are there certain kinds of movements I should really avoid? And what can I just generally do to preserve my knee strength? One of them is markedly weaker than the other.
So there are probably certain positions in yoga that put a lot of demand on your knees from a strength.
Squats. Seems like deep squats.
Right. So, and that really increases kind of the patellofemoral joint reaction forces the deeper in the squat we go. So my suggestion would be that seeing a physical therapist to get on a good general lower extremity strengthening program that would complement your yoga would be most helpful. And then the other thing is, once your knees are evaluated, your physical therapist can make suggestions on how to modify some of the positions in yoga. Because yoga in general is very good, but based on your diagnosis, there may be things that you need to modify.
Exactly. So the strengthening program will be for your your legs, your quads, your hamstrings, your calves, but also your hips, and making sure that you have sufficient mobility and strength in your hips to offload your knees.
Yeah, so, I've had IT band problems side, but I can manage that, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think literally seeing a PT for two or three times to get put on an independent program that you can do on your own and teach you how to progress it would be a tremendous help for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Agreed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You know, Mary emailed quite a while back and said her husband of six, who is 68, had knee replacement several years ago, plays hockey, baseball, and golf, and until recently was doing very well, now has a great deal of pain and stiffness when getting up from a chair. I can kind of relate to that. After a few steps, he, especially sitting here for 90 minutes and then getting up, it's always a little bit of an issue. But he's good after a couple of steps, which is me too. Would he benefit from seeing a PT for exercise to help him with the stiffness?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It sounds like he's remarkably active. And so I think taking a look at adjacent joints, looking at his ankle, looking at his hip, looking at his back to see if some of the stiffness is potentially coming from there. So the assumption is, well, it's my knee because I had a knee replacement, but it's also possible some of that stiffness could be coming from adjacent joints. Or if it is coming from the knee, we might look to those joints to compensate for the knee. So increase mobility in the hip, increase mobility in the back to compensate for whatever problems he might be having at the knee. He's already had a knee replacement, so we're hoping he's not going to have to redo that at this point.
Right, and that would be the other thing is if he hasn't seen his physician who did his total joint in a while, you want to make sure that that hardware is still in a good place and that there hasn't been something that's happened with that hardware as well.
There we go.
Yep.
Pat in Madison, we are on to you now. Hi, Pat. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I had a few issues that started back. I'm 59. Had a few issues that started back in the summer. My left hip was getting very difficult to lay on and had some lower back pain. Went to an orthopedic physician, and a very good one, and he said I had the greater trochanter bursitis. So I had an injection, and then I've been doing physical therapy, which has helped a lot. Actually, then I had another injection. That really seemed to knock it out. I still do, though, have a lingering ache right above that area where the bursitis was. I saw another orthopedic surgeon here in Madison, and he said I had gluteal medial tendonitis there.
Yep.
And that's
like
a
to me too.
Dog to get rid of. back to physical therapy. I've been doing that over at the new hospital here in Madison. And, gentle strengthening every morning and then doing gentle stretching and strengthening exercises that I've been doing. Also had some dry needling done. I think it helped. I'm not sure if it's really, it's not really handling the problem completely, but I think it helped. So I'm wondering what else I can do for this gluteal medial tendonitis, if anything, or if I have to just keep doing what I've been doing.
Yes, it takes a long time. That was last month's show.
Right,
wait for it. Yeah, it does take a long time. So, the therapist could push you harder, push you faster, give you more strengthening exercises, but that's at the risk of annoying it and sending it backwards. So, I always liken this to coming up on the edge of the Grand Canyon. So when you're far away, you can move fast. You're doing some injections. You're doing some strength, and you're doing some stuff, and you're getting better. But the closer you get to being better, the slower things are. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to slow things down, and you have to wait for it. You don't want to keep pushing it as hard at the end as you did at the beginning, or else you're going to tip yourself over the edge. So that's why the PT kind of moves you a little bit slower as you get closer to the finish. But other things you could consider would be like the pool as an adjunctive place to train. I assume you're doing some deep tissue work, like with the tennis ball as an adjunct at home, to do some deep acupressure right in that area. and that your therapist has worked with you on your gait, your mechanics, single leg stance, all those things.
Making sure you don't have a pelvic rotation of some sort that set all of this off.
Right, right, exactly. But it sounds like you're on the right course.
Yeah, I've had an MRI of the hip, an MRI of my lower spine.
Yep.
X-ray of the lower spine, nothing pathological.
Excellent.
So much,
excellent.
Other than mild.
Great.
Good.
Degenerative changes, I guess, like we all get. But
so I'd say stick.
You know, I just, one of the orthopedics suggested possibly that PRP treatment, you know, the protein-rich plasma, and I don't know what your thoughts were on that for the tendonitis.
Right. It's platelet-rich plasma, where they actually take some of your own blood, spin off the platelet-rich, and then they inject it into the area. You know, I don't know that there's a very much research specifically looking at the gluteus medius tendonitis for PRP, and I would say that you're probably better off going the dry needling route because it's quicker, it's easier, the recovery's faster.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't
give that a shot first.
No pun intended, right, Larry?
Yeah. I'd stick with your program. It sounds like you're on the right trajectory.
Yeah.
And it's just going to take a little more time.
They don't do the cortisone injections for the gluteomedial tendonitis?
No.
You've had two injections there already.
You don't want
in my bursa. Yeah.
You don't want a cortisone injection into a tendon.
Right.
There you go. Thank you for calling, Pat. And Jerry and Prada Sheen, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My question is, what can I do in exercise preparations with the 72-year-old Flatlander Wisconsin legs to prepare them for 5 to 6 days of alpine skiing in the Colorado Rockies?
Are you a golfer, by the way?
Don't know. I'm not.
Oh, okay. I just wondered. I had a friend who's in about your age range, and he went out skiing and broke his leg. And
oh, geez, Jerry. Thanks a lot for that one, Larry.
And so he couldn't golf all summer, and so he was really upset.
Well, you know, the old adage is the best way to train for something is to do it. So, granted, we don't have the mountains, but skiing would be the best way to prepare for skiing.
Yeah.
My expectations are when I ski that I do ski with fluidity, rhythm, and aggressiveness. I'm an intermediate skier. I just got back from a great trip to Steamboat Springs with the Madison Ski Loafers.
Okay.
During the first 2 days of skiing out there, I felt that aliens had abducted my body and left in its place one that was fearful, timid, uncoordinated, and weak, especially in the front of my legs from the top of the knees to the hips.
Those are your quadriceps muscles.
Yep.
So things that you can do is, so when you do ski, you're kind of in that little squat position and you rely on your quadriceps to be on for a prolonged period of time, depending on how long the hill is. For me, it's not very long. It's a bunny hill, but it sounds like for you, it's much longer. So doing strengthening where you're actually in that squat position and holding it or doing little bounce oscillations like you would be going over bumps would be a great strategy. You'd probably start with a minute and work up to a couple, 2-3 minutes. I would try doing some single leg standing exercises with that knee bent so the quadriceps have to be on.
Yep.
Particularly if you can do it without hurting yourself with your eyes closed, to work on your balance a little bit. So your body's used to taking your body weight on one leg with that knee bent, those knees and hips bent.
And I'd get a resistive band, a loop, and put it around my knees.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're doing those little squats or little oscillations, I put it on my knees and I'd pull my knees apart so you engage your glutes.
Yep.
And you can do some wall sits, you can do some wall slides up and down, you can pull your knees apart, you can go up and down at your kitchen counter, you know, standing by your counter in case you need to grab it for balance. As Jill said, with your eyes closed, I'd do some sidestepping, things like that with that band.
Yeah. So there you go. And when do you leave?
I just got back a week ago.
Oh, I see.
So should I add these exercises like all year then, just not 3 or 6 months ahead of the trip?
Well, it would be a good thing to do year round.
Yeah.
I don't know what your other physical activities are
you
the
a
rest
water
of the
skier?
Year, but yeah.
No, it's the angst, my arms out of the sockets. I do Pilates weekly. I do yoga weekly, and
it's
I
great.
Do,
yeah, I'd add this to that routine.
Yep.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jerry. And, you know, here we've been talking about dry needling, And we did describe it the last time you were on and talked extensively about it. But, of course, we're getting calls and some Facebook comments from people who are saying, what the heck is dry needling?
Sure.
And it's good to...
Absolutely
repeat that. So, Jill, you want to talk? Because you do it.
Yes,
you
I do. Yes, I do.
Expert at it.
I don't know.
I'm told.
I don't know if my patients would agree with that, but
you have
they
a
keep,
dry needle
they
me,
keep
but...
coming back. So apparently it's okay. So physical therapists in the state of Wisconsin can do something called therapeutic dry needling. So how this came about was when people got injections, they were questioning whether it was the actual injection of the medication that helped or the fact that the muscle was irritated or perturbed via the dry needle. So PTs in Wisconsin can take courses where they are trained to do therapeutic dry needling. And what we do is we use very, very thin needles that are not unlike needles that acupuncturists use. What we do is not what acupuncturists do. However, when I dry needle someone, I'm looking for that trigger point or that knot in their muscle. And I'll take the needle and I will inject it. And I'll kind of piston the needle around until I feel that knot, that trigger point. And what that'll do when I hit it is it creates a twitch response, or it actually makes the muscle twitch or contract. And what I'm trying to do, for lack of better term, is make the boulder in your muscle explode and go away. So for a muscle, I might use three or four different locations within the muscle to kind of break up those trigger points. We encourage the individual to use the muscle after they've been dry needled. So go and use it, create a good blood flow, stretch it out. Most people have muscle soreness where they feel like they've exercised that muscle for the first 12 to 24 hours. And then after that, they feel that the muscle relaxes, loosens up, and they feel great.
And then does it come back? See, do you need to come, you know?
So it can come back. So then the million-dollar question is, why did you get this trigger point in the first place? Why were you overusing this muscle so much? And do you have a muscle imbalance? So, of course, those things need to be addressed. So I use it kind of as a catalyst to get the rehab going. So now that we have this muscle under control, we need to fix the other muscles that were, as Lori would say, in the Barca Lounger and not working, and bring them up to speed so this poor little guy doesn't constantly get overworked.
So basically, it's go one time. I mean, to begin with, you go once. You hopefully get those exploded.
The analogy I give people are, it's like having a really, really dirty car. You take it through the car wash the first time, you get most of the crud off, and then you usually have to go back for like a second cleanup, and that's usually what it takes, is a couple, two, three visits.
Well, I'm glad we got that. Thanks so much. Brandy Funk for reminding me that I need to do my job and ask those follow-up questions sometimes that we get to take for granted from time to time. Well, here we are. We got some skiing going on next week.
The Berkey?
Yeah. The Berkey next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Jill and I are going to California on Wednesday.
Yes.
So we'll see our old friend, not our old friend, our friend Bill Boyson out there.
Yes,
those.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, say hello to
We have
Bill
a big meeting
us.
There.
We will.
So, and think of those people skiing while we're walking in the...
Right. Lori said, are you bringing a coat? And I said, no.
No.
She said, it's going to be 50 at night. And I said, no. No, yeah, 50 no. degrees sounds great.
Yeah. It sounds like short sleeves.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
We'll see you in a month then.
We'll see you in a month.
All right. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori with the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison. Always so much fun when they come by. And even though we're talking about sometimes some nasty kind of serious situations, but they do a great job of explaining them and what we can do to get better. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at your taxes. I haven't done mine yet. Have you? We'll talk some more about that tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network.